3, 2, 1. In a 3-hour time span, the search committee heard from more than a dozen people. What they heard wasn't surprising. UAF's new chancellor should be a good fundraiser, communicator, negotiator, and educator. Someone who appreciates the importance of vocational and technical education, understands the needs of faculty and staff, the needs of rural Alaska, and the importance of community involvement. Only about 8 members of the search committee were present to hear those suggestions, and they weren't surprised by the variety of job qualifications people expect. The search committee chairman Tim Tilsworth put it, they're looking for the Messiah. Faculty Senate President John Leipzig told the committee to choose a scholar and scientist for the job, someone who understands academics and has come up through the ranks, but someone who can also understand the needs of the UAF campus.
And when we're going to compete for our part of the pie in state dollars, I think that's where we're going to do best. I think someone who understands the sciences, understands scientific funding, understands the interaction between funding agencies and state government. I think we're going to have somebody who can help us more than capture both federal funds, state funds, and then also be an advocate down in Juneau.
UAF Director of Utilities Jerry England didn't ask for someone who understands personnel concerns, but rather physical concerns. England says campus buildings have so many age-related problems, it's going to take money to fix them so they can still be used.
We need a couple of million dollars a year for the next 4 or 5 years just to fix the roofs on the buildings on the campus. Our new chancellor is going to have a real struggle on his hands to try to get our fair share of the revenue to try to keep the buildings together, because we either fix the buildings or we close them.
The committee begins going through applications for the job this weekend. Chairman Tim Tilsworth says about 40 have come in, but there is no deadline for applications, and he expects to see more in the next 10 days. Tilsworth knows that the chancellor will be expected to fill a lot of different roles, and chances are they won't find one person everyone wants.
We've had some very good suggestions, things that will relate to the rest of the committee, and the characteristics are so broad and diverse that it's difficult to think there is an individual out there with all of those qualifications, but in fact there may be, and at least hopefully we can find somebody. If they don't have those qualifications, they'll be sensitive to the needs and willing to learn. It sounds kind of humorous, but we want someone who can walk on water, someone who's strong, will protect UAF's interests, will help us grow, will help us out of problems. And we don't want to focus so much on problems as we do on potential into the future.
The committee begins screening finalists for the chancellor's job in March. University President Jerome Commissar isn't expected to announce his choice for the job until May. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Taking the subsistence issue out of Somerville's jurisdiction is seen as an attempt to defuse the opposition to the controversial appointment. And the governor says it also demonstrates the urgency of finding a permanent commissioner of Fish and Game. In naming Somerville to the deputy position, where he'll have effective control of the department, Hickles says he's also recommending resubmitting Somerville's name to the boards for their consideration as full-time commissioner. And this time, the governor said he does not anticipate a face-off with the boards.
I have never been confrontational with the board. I've never gone to them and said, do this or do that. They were confrontational with me. I gave them three names, three good names, I thought. One of them withdrew before they met or before they had a chance to act. And so they had two, and I suggested to them that they could add some more names to that if they met that criteria. And they didn't seem fit to want to appoint any of my nominees or even recommend them.
In taking Somerville out of the picture on subsistence and putting it into his office, Hickles says he's naming a special working group to address the problem. But that's not a guarantee that the issue will finally be settled. Hickles says he's sending a signal, though, to the legislature and to rural communities.
I don't think we'll solve it till we solve it. What I want to do is let them know that we sincerely want to solve the subsistence issue. We believe we can solve it within the state government, and that's why I brought it into my office.
Hickles said he's advised and consulted with legislative leaders before making today's announcement. But as for a fight?
Not necessarily a real fight. There probably will be a lot of discussions, I expect that to be, you know, very deep, but I think we'll win.
Somerville was on hand for today's appointment. He says that based on what legislative leaders told him Friday, his confirmation as director is possible.
Like one of them said, if you don't stick your feet in your mouth, from now till confirmation, I don't see much problem with you in getting through.
And I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Legislators, native leaders, and others had warned Hickel not to appoint Somerville and get into a confrontation with the boards of Fish and Game or the legislature over this. And the immediate reaction when he did was, the honeymoon is over. One of Hickel's strongest allies in the legislature is Senate President Dick Eliason. But when Eliason learned from a reporter that Hickel had already announced the appointment of Somerville an hour before his scheduled meeting with legislators on the subject, he was not pleased.
Well, in that context, I think it's a short honeymoon. It's probably over. I would not like to see Somerville or anyone else as act as deputy commissioner beyond the confirmation dates of the other commissioners.
Hickel told lawmakers that he has an opinion from Attorney General Charles Cole that says he doesn't have to use a list of names from the joint boards to appoint a commissioner. But he's consulting them for now to avoid an even bigger fight. Cole says there is substantial legal authority to appoint a Fish and Game commissioner without reference to nominations from the boards. And state law refers only to commissioners being confirmed, not deputy commissioners. But Eliason says if this is an attempt to get around legislative confirmation, it won't work.
There will be no end run around the legislature. I'm sure of that.
House Speaker Ben Grusendorf agreed that reaction to this move will be very negative, and he was also surprised to hear the news before getting to meet with Hickel.
Well, it's kind of interesting that at 2:30 today, the leadership was supposed to meet with the governor to discuss this topic, and it appears to be after the fact, and that causes my eyebrows to kind of raise a little bit on that.
At the meeting with lawmakers, Hickel said that knowing the problems Somerville has had with subsistence, he's taking that decision out of his jurisdiction. At that same meeting, Hickel pounded the table, saying Fish and Game has to say that Alaska's resources must be managed by the state. He said the boards of Fish and Game are dominated by special interests and are part of the problem with subsistence. The legislature's ability to hold confirmation hearings on Somerville if he stays as a deputy are up in the air. Legislative attorney Tam Cook notes that the state constitution refers to the head of each principal department being confirmed. And if Somerville is in effect the head of Fish and Game, he could fall under that category. Meanwhile, some lawmakers are concerned that Hickel is simply biding his time until he can appoint new members to the boards of Fish and Game, members that will give him the commissioner he wants. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Board of Game Chairwoman Samantha Castle doesn't want to say much about the Somerville selection until she hears from the governor firsthand this weekend. Castle says she's going to assume Hickel's got a good idea. She's just waiting to hear what it is. But she does say that if there is going to be a battle over this choice, the battleground will be between the governor and the legislature. If the governor is merely waiting to name a commissioner until he can replace board members with his own people, Castle says she's not sure the legislature will allow him to keep an acting or deputy commissioner running things that long. And despite what the governor may think, Castle doesn't believe the board has been confrontational about the matter of selecting a new commissioner. She says it's just fulfilling its statutory responsibility. The Board of Game meets with Governor Hickel Saturday afternoon in Juneau. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Minorities make up a disproportionately high number of military personnel now stationed in Saudi Arabia, and some wonder why they should support President Bush's effort for war after he vetoed last year's civil rights bill. Michelle Parks is president of UAA's African American Club.
But why are we over there? And they say, like you hear on the news, we're fighting for democracy, to free Kuwait and all these other mess. What are we going to get when we get back as African Americans? We're still going to get kicked in the face.
Often poor young Americans are steered toward joining the military so they can eventually earn money to go off to college. Given so few alternatives in escaping poverty, they hardly seem like volunteers. Steve Cannon is in the reserves and a member of the African American Club. He says, like others, he's patriotic, but doesn't necessarily want to go and fight.
How am I supposed to go and kill some people, some brown people, you know, and you know, the police shooting my brother down left and right all because they thought they saw something, you know.
Right.
I have a real problem with going somewhere fighting somebody for a country that doesn't even claim me, you know.
Offering a different perspective on the war is a senior at East High, Onithia Riley. She says high school students are concerned, but they feel helpless.
being part of the generation that was fortunate enough to miss the Vietnam War. This war is something that we don't know how to cope with because we're kind of the video generation where everything just happens and, you know, we don't react to it. We just sit in front of the TV and watch it and shit and, you know, just do whatever. We just watch the television and we do what the television tells us to do.
Differences between the Vietnam and Gulf Wars were also talked about. A panel leader noted that even many Americans who show up for protests this time around support the troops fighting in the Gulf. Protesters view soldiers as pawns in a game being played by government officials. In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Murabito.
Jack London would probably approve of the Walt Disney Pictures production of his novel White Fang. After all, London wrote to make money, and this movie's likely to make a lot of it. It'll probably earn more for Alaska, too, luring visitors drawn by the sweeping views filmed by cinematographer Tony Pierce Roberts. White Fang, as told by Disney, is the story of two orphans, one a hybrid wolf cub adopted by Indians, another a young man, Jack Conroy, who's determined to find and work his father's gold claim in Alaska. Ethan Hawke of Dead Poets Society is Jack, and German actor Klaus Maria Brandauer is Alex, an experienced miner and a friend of the youth's father. With Brandauer, one gets a taste of the grit London would have preferred for this tale. Unfortunately, much early plot development is lost because poor sound quality renders his accent unintelligible. But the plot is easy to follow, and there's no character development to complicate things. Jack's on his way over the Chilkoot Trail to his father's claim. Alex is keeping a promise to a dead man by mushing his corpse to his chosen final resting place. The two team up against Alex's better judgment to help Jack get established. Meanwhile, the wolf pup is trained to pull by the Indian gray beaver, played by Alaska Athabaskan Pius Savage, who portrayed musher George Atla in the film Spirit of the Wind. But as White Fang matures, a trio of bad guys take him through trickery. They train the wolf to be a vicious fighter and rake in the gold of bored miners taking their R&R in town. Jack, once saved from harm by the wolf, now comes to White Fang's rescue. In the animal, the young man finds a tameable symbol of the mystery, beauty, and danger of the wild land that took his father's life. There's never any doubt he'll win Fang's trust, or that Jack himself will come through all his adventures unscathed. Still, the footage of Bart, the 9-foot-2 grizzly, who played the title role in The Bear, is impressive and may frighten young children. Those same children are sure to enjoy seeing the comic book villains get what's coming to them. It's all very light fare, including Hawk's sweet and amiable depiction of Jack. It's also fine family fare. There are no clumsy attempts to complicate the bear plot. Director Randall Kleiser has the wisdom to let the beauty of Alaska play the leading role. Production designer Michael Bolton and costumers Jenny Beaven and John Bright should take a bow for giving an authentic Klondike look to the people, towns, and buildings. Animal trainer Clint Rowe, in particular, deserves honors for his work, and in fact, Jed, the animal who did most of the acting as White Fang, headed the list of credits. Said to be the first major feature film shot entirely in Alaska, White Fang was based in Haines, with shooting in that vicinity and in Skagway. Of the $10 million that went into making it, $4 million found its way into the Haines economy. The producers had reason to question their choice of Alaska when they got rain instead of the snow they'd counted on. They also had to cope with the unaccustomed logistics problems of shooting in what for them was a remote location. Their compensation is a good-natured film whose weaknesses are submerged by the grandeur of the untamed Northland, the true star. And that probably is the way Jack London would have wanted it.
I'm doing the readings from the third and fourth grade. I had a very difficult time selecting which stories to read. I decided on a few of them. I thought I'd make a list of the other ones that were exceptionally offensive to me, and my list grew and grew.
They're gross. They're cruel, they're mean. They teach the kids how to be mean. And my 8-year-old is, she's a real sensitive little girl, and she comes home and tells me about these stories she's read, and she cries because they're mean, and you know, she doesn't like them, and the teachers force her to read them.
I grew up in Fairbanks, and I think they're awful. Yeah, I do. I don't like the image they portrays. There's nothing light about them. There's nothing hopeful, nothing responsible.
Careful, Connie. Careful Connie's terrified of accidents and ills, of gems and germs and things that squirm, heights and depths and heat and chills, of bicycles and buses, cats and cows and lakes and hills, flying things and furry things. So Careful Connie never will climb a tree, might fall down, go swimming, might drown, play in the rain, might get muddy, play games, might get bloody, cross the street, might get hit, pet a dog, might get bit, eat candy, might get a toothache, eat pizza, might get a bellyache, read a book, might ruin her eyes. Say hello, might have to say goodbye. Careful Connie's oh so carefully sitting in her room. She's absolutely safe there, just sitting in the gloom. She never laughs and never cries. She never falls and bumps her head. She's going to live forever, but she might as well be. This is called The Pocket by Sean O'Hugan. I reached into my pocket, and much to my surprise, something in there grabbed me and pulled me right inside. I felt its clammy fingers, all bony, cold, and thin. I tried to keep my head out. No use. It all went in.
Imagination for children is a wonderful thing, but I think they've gone overboard. And some of these things that I think would be terrifying to small children, if you've ever had to get up in the middle of the night to comfort a child, I just can't imagine what some of these stories will do to a little child. And I can see the witchcraft and all this emphasis on witchcraft and wizards and all of this. I think that's terrible.
Ha, 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 laughed the witch chief. And ha, 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 laughed the vultures and the wolves and the lynxes and the owls and the cats. Then they looked up and saw Zinni peeping in under the white rainbow. Zinni tried to run away, but they rushed at him and dragged him back into the cave. They tied his hands behind his back and stood him before the chief. You deserve to die for this, said the chief, but I will spare your life on one condition. Bring me the hearts of your mother and sister, and you shall live. Not only shall you live, but you shall become one of us. We will turn you into a mighty witch, and you shall help your wife to work evil. Then he ordered the creatures to freeze Zinni's arms and told him to go home. Tomorrow night I shall expect you again with your offering of hearts, he said. If you do not come, I shall see to it that your wife skins you alive.
In the witchcraft McCall's battle portrayed in the book, it is definitely a religion and it's recognized, and that's what I'm strongly opposed to.
I'm a gospel minister, and there's a lot of people that have told me stories about their children having nightmares and having a negative effect on their kids. You know, I personally don't have any kids, so I can't make a statement, you know, from a personal basis, but I am a taxpayer, you know, and if it has a negative effect on the kids, I think it's obviously a problem. They have said these are actually Christian stories when they're not at all. You know, like the wart, the wart snake and the fig tree, they say that's a Christian story. Well, it has nothing to do with Christianity. You know, in fact, it's slanderous and libelous. It's not education, it's deception.
A Wart Snake and a Fig Tree by George Mendoza. On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a wart snake in a fig tree. On the second day of Christmas, my true love gave to me two bags of soot and a wart snake in a fig tree. On the third day of Christmas, my true love gave to me three cobwebs, two bags of soot, and a wart snake in a fig tree. On the fourth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me four raven wings, three cobwebs, two bags of soot, and a wart snake in a fig tree.
You know, I would say probably half of the materials in the series is probably pretty good stuff. But, you know, the children don't know the difference. They have the books, you know, and you can't keep them from reading, you know, things that are questionable. Here last week, you know, the people that, of course, are for this series, they read, you know, all the good stuff, or at least some of the good stuff. You know, and they obviously didn't read any of the stuff that we read today, you know, because it's offensive.
I wanted to hear what the worst was that they had to offer. My impressions had been earlier that the stuff had a lot of good, interesting stuff that would that kids could get their hands on, and I wanted to see if the things that concerned this group were really scary and a problem, and I found nothing today that bothered me. Some of them are very funny, and some of them let the kids develop a lot of interesting alternatives to thinking about serious issues. I really loved it. It's good stuff.
We have to begin to look at the consequences of war much more deeply than we ever had before. I don't think we really see deep enough what horrible things come out of when we consider a war an option.
I think that Israeli lobbyists in Washington, D.C. have influenced George Bush and probably most of our Congress to pursue a military solution.
The mightiest nation in the world should be able to negotiate rather than just force a war and alienate all the Muslim people against us.
I'm struck by how the Vietnam years didn't seem to touch people, and they're willing to just say, yes, go do it. We said we're going to do it. Let's do it. And yet, on the other hand, we have Vietnam vets who are still trying to reorganize their lives and live happy, full lives.
I think our nation seems to always see international issues in black and white terms, and it seems to me that conflict resolution demands a view of the world that recognizes more shades of gray. In this case, we're focusing attention on this terrible bad guy, and through the buzzword linkage, we're refusing to acknowledge the complex conflict of Arabs and Israelis.
Our legislators were not paying attention to public opinion once more. I don't think Young, Stevens, or Mikulski had asked nor had listened to the people of Alaska as far as their opinion on sending the military into Iraq.
I just recently got out of the military myself, and if I hadn't gotten out, I would be over there. And I just wanted to say that I really believe that we're doing the right thing, and that all these people over here that are talking about how wrong we are really hurting the people overseas who are hearing this.
I believe that one of the basic faults of this entire situation is that our diplomatic corps is just not qualified to be in the diplomatic service. Every ambassador that's been appointed since day one, with a very, very few exceptions, have been a political appointment.
I think we're ignoring the elephant in the living room here. The U.S. is in an economic situation that it hasn't seen probably in its history. I think even during the Great Depression, the banking system is falling apart. The savings and loan situation is, we all know about that. The insurance corporations are in great trouble. Major corporations in the United States are facing bankruptcy. In short, we're paying the dues of the Reagan administration, where they just gutted our economic system. I think that we wouldn't be looking at a war that perhaps George Bush would have thought differently about sanctions if it wasn't for this economic pressure. And history teaches us that the real reasons for war are always economics.
I agree with the young man that just got out of the service that made the remark that he, the president, I may not agree, but I'm not in a position that I can do anything. But I support him and the people that are over there. I have a great respect for those. You know, I can't be there. So I say that I'm glad the boys are there, and I stand behind the president. Maybe he isn't right or wrong, but there's a no, Pat, this is the way to do it, or that's the way to do it. I think it's just a matter of he's doing the best he can. All of them are, and that's, I have to respect that because he's the man in authority that we have now.
I am getting a little bit tired of this buzzword linkage. What are we talking about here, sausage?
They've been meeting on Wednesday nights for the past few months. This Wednesday, the timing was right to take their message back to the street. It was a significantly smaller group than gathered for the candlelight vigil last month. Lou Brown was one of the 20 or so in this group.
I think we're just going to walk down Cushman Street to the bridge and then cross over the bridge and go to the Immaculate Conception Church. Father Loyan said we could go inside for a little while and maybe, I don't know what we'll do once we get in there, maybe just a little silence to think about what's going on and what we should do next. Everybody feels enormous frustration and fear and concern and what else can we do? I mean, we've already written, we've already made our statement. We just don't know. We're sort of at the end of our tether, I think. Oh, we are saved. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus.
They headed for the Cushman Street Bridge to stand for a short time. Mike Welsh was well ahead of them, standing on the corner while he waited for the group to arrive.
My sign says it is time to demand an international peace conference to resolve the Palestinian question. Let this be the last war in the Mideast.
Is anybody stopping to read it?
Yeah, quite a few people. I've even had a few GIs drive by and honk their horns. So I'm not so much protesting the war as I am hoping to set the agenda for a lasting peace. I would have preferred that he would have given economic sanctions and diplomacy a longer period to work. But I don't think that that Saddam Hussein should have been rewarded by, you know, our acquiescence either. I just think that we could have done this a different way. I'm very upset about this.
I just don't think that war is the answer to settling the problems over there in the Mideast at all. That there's a lot of other options that haven't been fully explored, and we need to look into those before we start killing people.
I started with the group before war was declared, thinking that the voice of the people would be heard, and it hasn't been. And so there's nothing we can do but keep protesting, keep trying to encourage other people to join in, because I think there are a lot of people who are against this. But unless we speak out, this madness is not going to be stopped. I have a nephew that is over there now. He just went over in December. But I'd be here whether he was there or not. None of the boys, none of the women should be there. They should be home.
Well, there's two sides of the coin. They're both are valid. But I don't see the Mideast being better after our objectives of smashing Iraq are through. I think it'll be worse off.
They lined the bridge for less than half an hour. Most of the drivers simply went along their way. Some hollered, some honked, and some simply flashed their headlights at the group. For KUAC News, I'm Ian Thornton.
I have been following the events in the Middle East as they unfold today. I want to express my heartfelt support for the families and friends of Alaskan troops who are involved. My wife, Ermeline, and myself want to say that we have you in our prayers. It is a sad day, but it's also a day when we must support the president with a difficult decision he has made. As far as Alaska is concerned, I've talked to state troopers just about 15 minutes ago. The Coast Guard has secured the Valdez terminal. The troopers have what they call the threat line 4. It's the highest priority. And so while our thoughts are over there, I want the people of Alaska to be assured that whatever we have to do to prevent any sabotage has been done.
The company has been receiving a lot of rumors and speculation over the last several weeks, and those that we feel deserve to be passed on to the FBI, we have passed on. But at this point, I can say we have no credible difficulties with the pipeline at this point.
Can you tell me how many of those threats you've passed on to the FBI?
No, I can't.
Can you elaborate on what any of them might have been?
No.
Spokeswoman Marnie Isaacs couldn't comment on much other than to say Alyeska remains in the same state of alert it announced Monday, with added security personnel for access control to the terminal. Electronic monitoring devices along the pipeline and at the terminal increased pipeline security, tightened personnel inspections within the pump stations along the line, and increased air and ground surveillance throughout the entire pipeline system. She says Alyeska remains in contact with Valdez city officials, but she says at this point, the city of Valdez and the terminal are not in danger. And she says Alyeska's concerns are more directly focused on troops in the Persian Gulf.
If we have any reason to believe that the system or the terminal is in danger, we will certainly advise the community.
Isaacs adds Alyeska has not asked military troops for help in defending the terminal, but they've said that will happen if the company feels it cannot protect the facility by itself. There has been no speculation on when or if that will happen. In Valdez, this is Mark Moran.
Chuck, we've heard over and over again that one of the reasons for this war is the security of world oil supplies. How are the markets likely to react to this conflict?
Well, I think the consensus is that there will probably be a blip up in price, in the price of oil, but given the fact that there are a considerable number of barrels in inventory right now, and given the anticipated further increases in production by Saudi Arabia, I think most people feel that any price spike would be short-lived and that prices will probably settle down and, in fact, will probably fall as we head into spring. But, of course, a lot's going to depend on how a conflict or the conflict unfolds.
What happened to the predictions we've been hearing weeks ago of $50, $100 oil?
Well, I think that those are fairly dramatic scenarios, and I don't personally, I've never felt that they were very very realistic. I mean, they're not outside the, it's not outside the realm of possibility, but I would say very, very unlikely that price could go above 50, and certainly prices that high are not sustainable. There's just too many alternatives to allow that.
What are analysts saying about OPEC itself now? Will there be an OPEC as we know it after the war?
I think the consensus is that there will be an OPEC. The quotas are off right now. They've been off ever since the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq. But at some point in time, given the fact that the OPEC countries contain the majority of the world's oil reserves that are available, they're going to have something to say about the price of oil.
How long do you think a downturn might last?
In our scenarios that we prepared for the revenue forecast last fall, our quick war scenario is sort of the dream of, I think, a lot of people, and that is that we return to stable oil prices at around the $20 barrel level very soon after the end of hostilities. The region-wide conflict was the other scenario we developed. I certainly hope, I think everyone would hate to see that. I don't see anyone spending a lot of time with that scenario, but obviously it's a possibility. In that case, the correction might be deferred for quite some time.
And that would involve things like oil facilities just being completely destroyed.
That's exactly right. Major and extended disruptions in supply to world markets. That's exactly right.
And that's the kind of wild card that could change this conventional wisdom.
Right, and it's just the kind of wild card that keeps this war premium on the price of oil, even though, there's plenty of oil available.
Chuck Logsdon is a petroleum economist with the State Department of Revenue.
3, 2, 1. The non-denominational F stamp features a tulip. Evelyn Morrison at Fairbanks Airport Post Office says they're selling them now, and business will likely pick up next week after the increase takes effect. But if the Postal Service had its way, Morrison says the stamps would cost 30 cents. The 29 cents approved by the Postal Rate Commission is still under protest.
We don't feel that the change in structure that the Rate Commission put in their proposal is going to meet our needs. Also, the 29-cent stamp just is a terrible burden. It's a burden for us, and it's a burden for the public. So we're not happy with it, but we're taking it under protest.
For the first time, the post office is also selling what it calls a makeup stamp. It's worth 4 cents and can be used with a 25-cent stamp to make up the difference. That stamp is filled with small print explaining exactly what it's to be used for. Postal rates across the board increase on Sunday, when it also costs more to express mail. All postal customers will be getting a mailing that explains the changes and the new postage rates. In the meantime, while customers are preparing to deal with the odd new price of a stamp, Evelyn Morrison says the post office is too.
We got to stock up on pennies, 1 cent stamps. Vending machines will not vend and give back pennies. These are burdens, plus just having the change in your till for your clerks. Pennies take up a lot of room. Besides, it's much more difficult to add up 3 29-cent stamps than it's 3 30-cent stamps, so you can... It's going to slow things down a little bit.
This postal rate increase is the first since April of 1988. 10 years ago, it cost 15 cents to mail a letter. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Besides education, the governor wants to axe the Social Services Block Grant Program. That money helps fund programs like the Soup Kitchen, a shelter for battered women, Head Start, and the Salvation Army. Former Governor Steve Cooper tried the same move last year and ended up restoring about 40% of the money. Social Services Director Jewel Jones says she hopes to educate the new administration on the dire need for these services, just like the public did for the Cooper administration.
I am hoping that collectively the agencies and all of us will be able to provide more information to the administration to make them aware, which we've had as a continual issue, making them aware of how very important this block grant is. As for other cuts, and that goes across the board in labor, community, and regional affairs, you know, many of these agencies that deal with social services issues, I think we're just going to really have to wait and see how this translates and what programs actually are affected.
The legislature seems to be where everyone is putting their faith for restored funding. In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Murabito.
Jim Sykes, who ran unsuccessfully for governor on the Green Party ticket, told a small group of reporters that the Greens support Hickel's call for economic development, not his interest in grand-scale megaprojects.
The proposed Alaska Investment Fund could be a good idea if it were done carefully. If the strategy is to use the Alaska Investment Fund as a clearinghouse for capital megaprojects, then we're headed in the wrong direction. The idea that large infrastructure should be built to attract development has never worked, and it won't work here. On the other hand, the fund could be used for a product development corporation, like we proposed during the campaign. Such a fund can be used to promote viable small business projects that are sustainable and environmentally sound for towns, villages, and families.
That's Green Party spokesman Jim Sykes.
On her new release, Rumor Has It, Reba McEntire starts a strong set of songs with an upbeat attitude, tempered with her yearning for an ideal, wholesome way of living. 2 years ago, her determination brought her to Alaska for the first time.
Narval Blackstock, my husband and I, came up on the Inside Passage on a cruise line, and we really enjoyed it. It was very relaxing, and the food was great, and the scenery was breathtaking. And we came up to Whittier and got on the train and went up to Denali Park. And then we stayed all night there and then came on up to Anchorage and then went on up to Fairbanks. And it was a very, very wonderful vacation.
The Grammy winner is making her performance debut this week with Kenai, Fairbanks, and Anchorage enjoying the pleasure of her company. Alaska's Hobo Jim provides an inspirational opening act before the nine-piece band takes the stage for the first time since New Year's Eve.
Alaska is someplace I've always wanted to come, and now we've met a lot of friends since we've been skiing in Colorado who take care of lodges up in Alaska. That's the only place, only way you can get in to the lodges are with, you know, by a plane, and you land on the lakes, and so that's another thing we want to do.
McEntire says she's glad more booking agents are looking north for new audiences and is already anxious to get back to Southeast.
Especially Skagway because it was so rustic, and Juneau because it was just beautiful. We went up on the glacier, took the helicopter tour, and I want to hit more points in the state. I think it's a wonderful, beautiful state, and as they say, it's the last frontier.
And a new frontier for the music industry since the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts opened its doors. Reba and her Alaskan fans share a mutual admiration as she brings her warm sense of humor, an air of oaky charm, the breathtaking beauty of her range, and the show that leaves music lovers proud.
We do promise them an entertaining show. It's a family show, and we promise them a good time.
Beautiful concert, yeah. Just beautiful. She's got just a beautiful voice. She sang Sweet Dreams. That's about the only country singer I know, young one, who could do such a good job on that one. It's great.
It's great. Yeah. Loved good it. Show. Yeah. Good show.
She was just a showwoman. I mean, I didn't expect it. I knew her voice was good, but I didn't expect her to be so wonderful on stage.
Yeah.
She was great to watch.
With Reba in Anchorage, I'm Larry Yarrow.
Three, two, one. Most events celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. here were held on Saturday. The guest of honor this year was Johnny Ford, now mayor of Tuskegee, Alabama. Tuskegee is just a few miles from Montgomery, where King led the fight for desegregation while Johnny Ford was growing up.
As a boy, I would often go and listen to him. He was in Montgomery, and we were 40 miles away in Tuskegee. So my father would take me to the rallies, and I was just a young admirer who listened to him and marveled at the great work that he was doing. And of course, we, in the student nonviolent movement, we started to follow in his footprints, in a sense, by being active in his movement.
Ford now is chairman of the World Conference of Mayors, an organization made up of 1,100 mayors from 32 nations. Ford says while attention is on the Persian Gulf this year, he wants to acknowledge the service of men and women there.
Dr. King was a peaceful man, but even he would have had to admit, were he alive today, that most everything was done to try to resolve the situation in a peaceful way. If Dr. King were here, he would want this war to end as soon as possible, as we all do, so that our men and women can return home safely.
Tuskegee's mayor says it's time to rededicate ourselves to the concepts and ideas that Martin Luther King Jr. worked and lived for, because the struggle isn't over.
Well, our country and our nation has come a long way since the 60s, but there is still a long way for us to go until the day really comes when all Americans and all of the peoples of the world will begin to really accept one another as equal and be able to live and work together in peace.
Tuskegee, Alabama Mayor Johnny Ford, Fairbanks' guest of honor for this year's Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Last fall, KUAC worked on a series called The Prejudice Puzzle. At the time, we wanted to profile a community leader who serves as a role model for minority children. We didn't have time to do it then, but since today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we thought it was a perfect time to reacquaint you with Yvonne Ryans, principal at Ryan Middle School, who we interviewed last August.
Let's go to class. You're supposed to be in seventh hour. You're out here in the hallway. You're late. Hurry.
I have to go.
Are you supposed to be in the high school?
I'm done, man. Yeah.
Oh, for the day on Friday?
Yeah.
Oh, I must have made a mistake.
What
are you?
Right here.
Yvonne Ryans is the kind of principal many of us remember from our elementary school days. In the hallways a lot, talking to students as if she knows them all personally. But unlike principals in many schools 20 years ago, Ryans is a woman, and a black woman at that. She knows what it's like to set precedents, particularly in a community like Fairbanks. Ryan says attitudes about race relations haven't changed a lot over the years, but in Fairbanks, it's an especially slow process.
Well, I came here 10 years ago, and I was the first black to be hired in this school district, principal of an elementary school. 10 years ago. I am, right now, the only black female in the secondary school. So they lost me out of the elementary, right? And I'm in the secondary. So I'm breaking the same ground that I broke 10 years ago. So has there been any change? Now, in 10 years of social change and the women's movement and all that, what's happened in Fairbanks?
Ryan says there is racism in Fairbanks, but it's racism by omission. Instead of talking about differences between people and cultures, Ryan says Fairbanks overlooks those differences.
It's not the familiar racism where someone may have seen, as far as black folks do, talk about Jim Crow laws or labeling of water fountains or sitting in the back of the bus. I mean, many of those things are not as evident but may still be practiced without the signs. There are no blatant signs here, anywhere in Fairbanks, that discriminate against any particular group. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I think a lot of people have accepted that, thought that, well, the civil rights movement took care of everything. And so that doesn't exist anymore. But that's not true. It's still there. It may be have gone underground. It may be in subtle ways, as opposed to being in just plain, straight-out, blatant signs.
Ryans believes it's better to celebrate differences among people rather than ignore them. And she's helping students of all races do that simply by her presence at Ryan Middle School. But Ryans admits it can be frustrating to work for change but not know if you're making a difference.
The torment that I put myself through is, if I leave here, will somebody black replace me? So I go through the torment of, who am I helping or who am I fooling? Sometimes I think, well, maybe I'm doing some good. Maybe it's just very little. Maybe it's just, maybe for them it's a first. Most of these white kids in this town, the I'd say 90% of them have never had a black teacher. I never had one. I had, my teachers were in college, but I never had one through high school and elementary. I didn't have one. This year I hired a black lady to teach special ed at this building. But there's nobody else. So kids can go through and never know, except what the media puts out at them, is that this is what black is, or this is what Korean is, or this is what American Indian is.
Yvonne Ryans walks the halls at Ryan Middle School, reminding kids just what black is. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Why have Saddam Hussein's pilots failed to put up much of a fight? Evans said the Iraqis probably had little warning.
And the early defense warning system was circumnavigated in some manner by our electronic devices and our measures that we were able to go in and take those out before they could get to the aircraft.
The first Allied airstrike at Iraq came while it was dark. And Evans said night flying in the Mideast can be just as dangerous as night flying in the Arctic.
The desert is very similar to the tundra, in the fact that when you're out flying at night, there are no ground references. It's just like sticking your head in a pillow because there's nothing out there to help you at all.
He said he could not persuade his Iraqi students to put more emphasis on night flying.
When I went over and devised a training program, I wrote a scenario, a course of instruction for helicopter pilots who had been being trained under British and Russian programs. And I had written into the program a standard U.S. program whereby a initial entry pilot got 3 hours of night training in his primary training. And then in the advanced training, he would get 5 more hours. They said, oh, no, we do not fly at night.
Evans said, based on available information, the Allied pilots have done very well so far with relatively few losses.
Less than we've had during the past 5 months in training missions. And we have been engaged in actual combat. We've been going out and really going and taking it to them.
In Barrow, I'm Earl Finkler.
News of open hostilities in the Persian Gulf broke at about 3 o'clock on Wednesday. Tom Jensen, Director of Public Affairs at Alascom, says that right about that time, long-distance call volume rose dramatically. Jensen says Alascom handled 450,000 attempted long-distance calls statewide on Wednesday, most of them to other parts of Alaska. The company was only able to put 325,000 of those calls through. Jensen says normal volume on an average day is 250,000 calls. General Communications Incorporated, or GCI, handles only out-of-state long-distance calls. Nancy Snyder, GCI's Director of Resident Services, says overall traffic at her company went up about 15% Wednesday.
The difference of in-operator services of instead of 1,700 calls, we actually had 2,100 calls go through from 3 o'clock until midnight.
Snyder says 1,700 calls is a more typical volume for that period on a Wednesday. According to Tom Jensen, Alascom is providing what he calls morale phones to troops in remote locations in Saudi Arabia. Those services and additional classified services for military uses are being generated by 11 satellite Earth stations. 15 Alascom employees are in Saudi Arabia to staff the satellite stations. Tom Jensen says those employees are in a secure area and protected by the military. Jensen says Alascom officials spoke with them and they were all safe and well. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jennifer Woodhull.
Three, two, one. The two-paragraph news release arrived via fax, simple and to the point. Mayor Juanita Helms says she won't be running for a third term.
I've enjoyed being mayor for a long time, but there is a heavy commitment that a person has to make when they decide to run. The time that it takes to campaign and that sort of thing takes away from the job that you want to do. And the fact that I've got so many interests that I would like to pursue, and I can't do it when I'm mayor, I decided it was time for someone else to take the job.
Helm says she wanted to make the announcement early so that others will have time to plan a campaign.
I have had people ask me the question, and I decided that if I was not going to run, the sooner I said so, the better.
Helms has frequently been at odds with the borough assembly over how to run the borough. In fact, it was almost exactly 1 year ago that she filed a lawsuit against assembly members, accusing them of passing ordinances to limit her authority and claim it for themselves. That later was settled out of court. There has been a lot of speculation about possible contenders for the mayor's job. Now with Helms out of the picture officially, it could be a long and lively campaign in the borough. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. During his budget address, Governor Hickle pointed out that departments had to cut as much as 11% to reach the overall 5% budget reduction he wants. So he's asking what he calls sharing programs to absorb a 5 to 7% reduction, programs like municipal assistance and the Education Foundation formula. Cuts like that could have a $10 million impact on the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, according to Superintendent Rick Cross. Cross says the district needs more money next year with additional labor costs and inflation, and even with the same amount of money from the state next year, Cross says they'd have to cut about 5%, but the governor's proposal will mean twice that much. Cross says the money could not be made up locally either, so what Hickel's proposing would be very painful. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The $2.1 billion budget proposed by the governor represents a cut of nearly $110 million. It's actually deeper than that, though, since state agencies would be required to absorb $34 million for pay raises and the cost of inflation at about 6%. Hickle says his administration has begun the process to make government as lean and as professional as possible. His budget is based on a reduction of more than 600 full and part-time jobs, which he says won't come from mass layoffs, but through attrition and more efficient management. The biggest cuts would be in the departments of education, law, and in the university system. The governor also wants to raise the minimum age qualification for the longevity bonus from 65 to 67 and cut the bonus by 5%. That would translate into about $12.50 a month, taking the check from $250 to $237.50. Hickel also proposed creation of the Alaska Investment Fund to finance major public works that would benefit resource development. The fund also is to be used to pay off state debt by the end of this decade. He wants to start the fund with an expected oil windfall of at least $600 million. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
By having this position, it gives us the point of contact that we need, and we anticipate that all solid waste projects in the borough will move forward a lot faster and a lot smoother than they have in the past.
3, 2, 1. The rumor mill started months ago. The announcement by Borough Mayor Juanita Helms not to seek re-election only fueled it some more. Helms was one of the names on the list of possible candidates. One other name on that list is former mayor and assembly member Harold Gillum. Gillum says he will be in the race for mayor this fall.
Well, I think I can add quite a bit to the position of mayor and maybe ease some of the problems between the assembly and the administration. I got irritated when the assembly got sued by the mayor. That
it was a year ago.
I'm still not happy.
Just who else will be in the race? Well, Assemblywoman Bonnie Williams says she's thinking about it.
Because the borough needs a good mayor. The borough deserves a good mayor. And if there are no good candidates, I might very well run.
Some other assembly members say they won't be running, but when asked to list the names of people they've heard who will, one name keeps coming up.
It's probably easier to say who's not going to run.
Boy, there's been 1,000 names thrown around. I understand Chris Birch is.
I've heard some speculations, but, you know, I'd rather you talk with him about it.
Who do you suggest I talk to?
People like Chris Birch, maybe.
Juanita's name was in there for a long time, and she just pulled it out tonight. I understand that Chris Birch is considering running.
Former Assemblyman Chris Birch says he's taking a strong look at running for mayor, but still has a lot to consider and will probably decide in the next month or so. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Dr. Ted Mala took over the sprawling $580 million Department of Health and Social Services, determined to make some big changes. Most of those have been waiting, however, while he wrestled with a $12.5 million budget cut requested by Governor Hickel. Unlike some commissioners, Mala decided to make his cuts across the board, with very few exceptions. And among the programs being cut are some of those that serve Alaska's mentally ill population. The exact size of the cuts will come with the governor's presentation of the budget, but Mala says he couldn't set mental health aside when making reductions.
Who is to say that mental health is more important than physical health? I mean, do we say that we should take all the cuts out of diabetes and tuberculosis and leave mental health alone?
The mental health advocates, who have had to take the state all the way to the Supreme Court over what they call Alaska's dismal record of caring for its mentally ill, these proposed cuts strike a serious blow at attempts to settle a long-running dispute. Anchorage attorney Jim Gottstein says the cuts are a gross violation of federal law, and he says not only should mental health programs not be cut, but the state mental health board is recommending some $43 million in increases for mental health programs next year. And Representative Mark Boyer, who oversees the Health and Social Services budget for the House Finance Committee, says this is no time to be cutting mental health funding.
Well, my initial reaction is that it's a breach of faith, good faith, that the legislature has been making for at least the last 6 years. It's just unfortunate that a governor and a lieutenant governor who campaigned so aggressively on dealing with the issue in a positive and forthright manner would propose reductions in that program.
Mala says he knows the cuts will be controversial, but the mental health trust dispute needs to be solved by the governor, the legislature, and the courts. He's just trying to run his department. On other issues, Mala hopes to someday disentangle health and social services from some of the massive and controversial programs that keep costs spiraling upward, like Medicaid. He says Medicaid costs are increasing 20% a year.
And as far as I'm concerned, it's a black hole right now.
It's a nationwide problem, but so far no state has gotten out of the Medicaid program, mainly because it offers huge amounts of federal dollars. But Mala is setting up a task force to try and find a way to make Alaska the first to reject the federal money and replace it with some state program. Boyer admires Mala's motives and creative energy, and he agrees that Medicaid has big problems. But Boyer doubts the wisdom of walking away from $250 million a year.
The Medicaid budget brings about $250 million a year into the state and affects lives. It's direct cash payments to facilities and providers that the state of Alaska cannot, I don't think, easily replace.
To Dr. Ted Mala, it's one more opportunity to shake up one of the biggest and most problematic agencies in state government.
If the people of Alaska did not want radical changes, they would not have elected Governor Hickel.
For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon. Hickel told reporters that the meeting was set up on extremely short notice and included Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan, Exxon Chairman Lawrence Rawl, and President Lee Raymond, Environmental Protection Agency head William Riley, the Deputy Secretary of Commerce, and Hickel and his Attorney General Charles Cole. U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh was also briefed on the talks, according to Hickel. The governor said this high-level gathering was unusual, and he hopes it will lead to a comprehensive settlement of all present and future federal and state charges against Exxon resulting from the 11 million gallon oil spill. This was the first mention that the settlement may include not only the civil claims, but the criminal charges as well. Ickle says he's pushing for a settlement that covers everything.
I'm saying that we came up with the idea of settlement, Prince William Sound, Marine Park, having a global settlement, I mean, including everything. That's why we brought the federal government in. My experience in negotiations, if you can bring everything together, that's what we did.
Ickle didn't discuss any of the specifics from the talks, but his idea for putting the Exxon Valdez behind Alaska has included such items as a payment from Exxon that would go into a trust fund, and a Prince William Sound Marine Park that would restrict other development activities, such as timber cutting. Ickle also says Exxon would have to pay the bills racked up by the state and federal governments. He says that Exxon appeared pleased by the fact that the trust would not be the exclusive property of the state of Alaska, but managed by a panel that includes Exxon representatives.
And I know you can write this any way you want to. You can write it with malice, or you can write it any way you want to. The thought is to have a trustee thing set up where the state would have two or three people, the federal government would have two or three people, Exxon might have one. That's the thought.
So far, Ickle has been out front on the settlement issue, but some lawmakers are trying to catch up. Senate Oil and Gas Chairman Sam Cotton is asking for a briefing.
That's why I think the legislature right now, it would be smart for us to get some sort of briefing just to make sure we all understand all the issues, what the criminal charges are, and what some of the details are so that we can follow along and perhaps give the guy some advice.
Ickle says another meeting is planned in Washington next week, timed to coincide with the National Governors Association meeting there. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
In a letter to trustees Mark Langland, Byron Millott, and Charles Parr, Ickle thanked the trustees for their service to the state, but said their services would no longer be required. Press aide Harry Gamble reads from the letter.
The performance of this board has been commendable. However, as has been the case with many other boards, I have elected to appoint new leadership to carry out its assignments. Therefore, I must confirm that your service on this board is no longer required effective February 1, 1991.
Chairman Mark Langland was not available for comment. He served on the board since 1987. Byron Millott has just been reappointed to his third four-year term by Governor Steve Cooper in July. He says he's not challenging Hickel's authority to terminate trustees before their terms are up, but he adds that he hopes politics isn't invading the management of the state's $11 billion savings account.
There has to be some kind of purpose for replacing the all of the trustees but one. I just don't think that it's a good precedent for the Alaska Permanent Fund, and I just don't think that it's good public policy.
Millott is a prominent Democrat and played a key role in Tony Noel's bid for governor last year. Former Fairbanks legislator Charles Parr also questioned Hickel's move, saying it's not a good idea to change board members wholesale. The three fired trustees are to be replaced by former lawmaker and trustee Oral Freeman of Ketchikan, Carl Brady Jr. of Anchorage, and Ralph Seekins of Fairbanks. The only private sector trustee to escape the Hickel axe is John Kelsey. His term expires in a few months.
In the budget he presented to the legislature last week, Governor Ickle proposed cutting more than $50 million from the Department of Education. This bill restores those cuts and leaves the legislature and governor some $70 million apart. The bill was introduced by House Rules Committee Chairman Johnny Ellis.
Support of public education is a very clear mandate of the state constitution. And so full and early and fair funding, all those are kinds of adjectives to use. That the public supports very strongly, and I don't think Governor Ickle is taking is fully cognizant of.
The education budget's being considered separately and early for two reasons. First, so local school districts can have time to work out their own budgets and avoid losing teachers due to uncertainty about state contributions. The second, unspoken reason is to test Governor Ickle's resolve about cutting operating expenses while the legislature is still in session to override any possible veto. Ickle wants to spend $646 million on education, but Ellis says full funding can be easily justified to more than $700 million.
Public schools aren't a cheap thing to run, especially in this state where there's such diversity and kids, you know, spread out all over the regions of the state.
The bill now goes to the House Finance Committee, and members there promise to ask for clarification from the administration on several points. Noticeably about how the operating expenses fit into the capital budget, which will come later. Mark Boyer is a member of the House Finance Committee. He sees a discrepancy between the cutbacks the governor wants and the method used to retire the debt for past school construction. The state's share of the debt service is reduced in the HICL operating budget, and that adds up to more expense to local governments.
Full funding for debt service is about $129 million this year. The governor's proposal is $110 million. So you've got, I mean, that's the difference. You see the difference. And that, I think, has always been a major fighting area for the legislature. And it will continue to be a major fight this year because we all understood that there was a different level of commitment. And apparently this governor, who says he's committed to paying off debt, hasn't looked at this particular line of debt as one that he's committed to fully funding.
He says this means the short funding really isn't $50 million, like the administration says. By changing the debt service load, it's more like $65 million. And the way he sees it, the governor's only shifting the burden from the state to local governments.
To the extent that local government can accept that within existing statutes, I suppose that that's a philosophical discussion we have to have. How much should local government contribute? But it's just a dollar shift. It's a cost shift. It's not a real savings to government.
Representative Ellis doesn't want to call the bill a showdown between the governor and the legislature. He points out that his bill is based on established formulas that have not been followed in recent years. He says the numbers were established long before HICL was ever elected governor, and he's introduced similar legislation before, since early funding was a campaign theme for a lot of candidates last year. But the effect of the bill is a challenge to HICL, and Ellis expects some disagreement.
You know, obviously the governor with this proposal doesn't agree with full funding of education, and he has his prerogatives available to him, and we have ours. So I think it's a real healthy discussion. I don't think it'll be too bitter of a battle because I think in the end people are going to want to support kids in the classroom.
The bill is expected on the House floor as early as Friday, and the Senate begins studying the education budget next week. This means the measure could be resolved by the legislature and on the governor's desk long before the end of the session. And if the bill is basically unchanged when it gets there, it could spark HICL's first budget confrontation. The director of the Office of Management and Budget, Shelby Stastny, didn't return phone calls on the subject Tuesday. And HICL's press aide, Harry Gamble, also had no comment. I'm Dave Donaldson.
3, 2, 1. People who are arguing with the superintendent's decision to keep the books in the schools get to offer testimony for almost two full evenings. A third night allows for public testimony. Sign-up for public testimony begins at 6 o'clock next Wednesday night, February 6th, but that testimony won't be taken until Friday night from 7 o'clock until 11:30. Until then, 45 people who object to the books will be given 9 minutes each to testify and present witnesses Wednesday and Thursday nights. Late on Thursday evening at approximately 10:15, School Superintendent Rick Cross will be given an hour to defend his decision to retain the Impressions textbooks. The hearings before the school board take place at Ryan Middle School. School board members are expected to make a final decision about the books on the 19th of February. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.